Good morning, everyone. Today is Thursday, February 19th, 2025, and I want to call to order the board meeting of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin and also the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation.
One correction, it's the 20th, not the 19th.
Oh, the 20th, I'm sorry. The 20th of February, 2025, and it is 9:12 a.m.
Commissioner Bailey, Commissioner Apostolo. Commissioner Apostolo, are you there? Commissioner Duncan Hall?
Present.
Commissioner Ritchie?
Present.
And Commissioner Carrington?
Present.
Reconfirming, Commissioner Apostolo, are you there?
There she is.
There she is, great. We have a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so we're officially called to order at 9:12 a.m. on February 20th, 2025. And so with that, we will have the Pledge of Allegiance and then public comments if there's any.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Chairman, Zenobia Joseph is here for public comment.
Okay.
Ms. Joseph, would you like to come forward? And you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Zenobia Joseph. I know the last time, Mr. Chair, you combined all the items together, but today I'll just speak individually when those items come up, if that's your preference. I just wanted to call to your attention, you have the grievance policy on a later agenda.
Ms. Joseph, let me just clarify with council. We have one public comment opportunity. You have 3 minutes to make all of your public comments now on any issue before the board. Is that correct, council?
So this changes from the last meeting?
It's been our policy. I think there was an effort to try to make an accommodation, but the policy going forward and has been consistent is you have 1 3-minute public speaking opportunity.
For the action items, too?
For any item you wish to address to the board today.
And I appreciate that, Mr. Gerber. I would just say that normally action items are separate from comments related to items that are not on the posted agenda. I would just call to your attention to the board respectfully my request for you to resign. I recognize that you make $325,000. It is highly inappropriate for you to call my friend and discuss my personal matters. There is a specific Privacy Act of 1974 which prohibits the discrimination and also the release of public personally identifiable information. I came before this board October 17, 2024, again in November. Your December minutes are not posted. I want you to recognize that I have been here. You asked me to give you a week until Ron Cole came back from a trip. You never spoke with me. And on Saturday, you called my friend and discussed all kinds of information about me, from background check all the way to whether or not I work, all of the things related to the HUD-VASH voucher, yet you've never discussed those issues with me. It is highly inappropriate. I have reached out to Ryan Jones, who is actually the Federal Register point of contact, and he has forwarded the information and my concerns about you, Mr. Gerber, to the field office. By now, you should have received at least a question about that. I would just ask that you be as transparent with the policies for grievances for the staff as you are with the public. And on page 26, there is a recommendation for you to post the housing choice voucher utility information online. I would just ask you to post the information related to the HUD-VASH voucher program online. I went to the VA yesterday and I'm working through that process. You received $6 million on December 8, 2022, the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. And I would say that we need someone else who cares about veterans to actually distribute those vouchers. You have said that I am confused to my friend. I am not confused. The Federal Register, dated August 13, 2024, specifies that these vouchers are for all homeless veterans. If you don't understand what the policy states, then you need to read it respectfully. If you have any questions, I'll gladly answer them, but there is an error in the minutes from the last meeting, and that is for you to correct. I am not against Belveron. I stated ADA noncompliance. I would ask your staff to either write ADA noncompliance or to put Title VI, because I showed the pictures, and respectfully, your IT staffer said that he was not able to put the items up, but he did print the issue for you to see it. If you have any questions, I'll gladly answer them. At this time, I would ask you to post your change to your minutes and to your speaking online. Thank you.
Ms. Joseph, with the chairman's forbearance, because you raised a matter of a personal issue, I would just simply say to you that we have tried to introduce you to members of our team who work in the VASH program, and we have introduced you to, and we've tried to explain the process to you. It's out of the hands of this agency. Both ECHO with coordinated assessment and the VA have to make the referrals for the type of voucher you're seeking. Your friend has reached out to us, and I had a brief conversation and returned the call. And I did say that we cared about trying to provide you with housing. She indicated, as you have indicated, that you're at housing risk. We said that we're in the housing business, and all we're trying to do is get people housed or to keep people housed. Everyone here really feels very badly that the VASH program doesn't work as well as it should. And we're sorry that it's backed up on you. I wish there was something I could do to help you. And I hope you feel, I know you don't feel, but there are a lot of people here who have had conversations just in this building trying to figure out, is there something we could do to figure out a way to make something a little better, because you've made a compelling case to us. There are far too many people who don't have housing in this community. I'm sorry for your circumstance. No one here has tried to do anything that's been of hurt to you. Everyone who I've talked to, you know, and we've hit obstacle after obstacle, and you know, but the folks here are just simply trying to help. I'm sorry you don't feel that way, and I respect your opinion, but I just wanted to at least say that to you.
And I thank you, Mr. Gerber, and I won't be long so that the meeting can continue. I would just say to you that I did receive from Kelly Crawford an email that said I could only communicate with her, and when I tried to put in an open records request, it bounced, and your email bounced as well, though I've never emailed you before. And so while I certainly respect that you made these comments on the record, the bottom line is that there is a Privacy Act. And so even if someone reaches out to you, that governmental body or quasi-governmental body has a right to say, I thank you for your call, but we're not able to discuss this matter. But you proceeded to discuss it not once, but twice. And so I just respectfully would say, I did meet with your staff, but you blocked my emails, and that is retaliatory. Sorry. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Chair. Last thing I'll say, we have not blocked your emails. We did have some server issues, and we did direct you to work directly with Kelly, but you're welcome to contact me anytime. But no other member of our staff, except for me and for Kelly, are responsible, or Sylvia, our chief operating officer, have responsibility for your issues. You're not a client here, and you're not a resident here yet. And so there's no one else to work with. So if you have an issue, we've directed you to work with Kelly, because she's most familiar with getting it to the right person, and you're always welcome to email me. We have had points where our systems have been down because we've been doing conversion, and I'm sorry that you received a blocked message. I would encourage you to resend it. I would say you probably only had that happen once.
I changed emails, so I don't know, but thank you.
Okay.
Is there anyone else signed up to speak?
No, sir, there's not.
With that, we will go to the next item, which is...
Mr. Chairman, Azar is here as well. We'd like to have him speak for a few minutes. The board in the past has asked for a quick overview on the environment here in terms of both real estate and housing policy. And so Aves, who's the executive director of Housing Works, is here to give us a quick overview. And let's turn it over to him for a few minutes.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, board members. I was here before you at your last meeting just sharing some data. Wanted to follow up with a few more items, really the main focus being just looking at some of the metrics around housing affordability and affordability in general in both Austin and also Travis County. Let's see, am I able to? Oh, there you go. So the first is really, you'll see this is slightly older data because we're looking at data from 23. We're still waiting on the Census Bureau to release data for 24 so we can crunch it. But there's just a few things here that I would want you to be looking at. One is the number of units that are subsidized. So if you see within the city of Austin, we have a significant amount now. We're nearing 60,000 subsidized affordable units. These are either that are already existing or in the planned phase, and so they're going through. They might not have certificate of occupancy yet. The other thing that's worth noting is the cost of living box. So if you see, the median family income in the city of Austin has jumped significantly for this is for a family of four. And what we see is that at the same time, we've had rents and home prices go up significantly as well. Now, there's been 2023 was the first year where in the data we see a few declines, and I think they have continued through 24. But regardless, they're still significantly higher when you compare them to the pre-pandemic rents and sales prices. So, again, looking at this data from 23, we're looking at over $1,600 in rent per month. This is for an average-sized unit. At the same time, though, while income has gone up, poverty rates seem significant. We're talking about more than 118,000 individuals living below poverty in the city of Austin. That's a 12.4% poverty rate. That's still very significant. And although that number has dropped over the years, we know that part of it is that we've lost low-income folks in the city of Austin. And that is why it continues to sort of look that way. The other thing that's worth looking at is the cost burdened. So cost burdened are folks essentially who are paying more than 30% of their income on housing. We do not, you know, there's a HUD guideline, a federal government guideline, and locally as well, that if folks are paying more than 30% of their income on housing, they're considered cost burdened, i.e. they're really having to cut back on things in other parts of their life, like healthcare, childcare, so on and so forth. Extremely cost burdened are folks that are essentially spending more than half of their income on housing. At that point, your household finances are extremely stressed. What I want to point out is that even though in the state of Texas it's significantly high, we're looking at 31% folks who are paying more than 30% of their income. When it comes to the city of Austin, it's even more. So more than one-third of Austinites are paying more than 30% of their income towards housing costs. And more alarmingly, 16% of Austinites are spending more than 50% of their income on housing costs. That's very significant. Looking at the... Yes.
Sorry, you said there's only extremely cost burden. Is that families who are paying more than
50%? 50%, yes, ma'am. For Travis County, really, we're looking at, again, looking at both subsidized units. We're specifically looking at numbers outside of the city of Austin. So 9,000 units across the county outside the city of Austin. It's important to sort of think about that. But more importantly, you'll see the cost of living is still quite comparable to the city of Austin. So the rents are similar. Median home price, again, while prices have dropped, they have remained pretty significant compared to the pre-pandemic prices that we were seeing. Same goes for poverty rate, again, significantly high, over 142,000 individuals living below poverty in our county. And, of course, a significant amount of folks are experiencing unsheltered homelessness. These are folks who are not living in any shelter space, are actually living on the streets. And then again, looking at cost burden for Travis County, we do see that Travis County also has higher cost and extreme cost burden than the state of Texas. I mean, again, we're looking at more than one-third of folks in our entire county paying more than 30% of their income on housing-related costs. Not to belabor too much, but just, you know, a few quick things in comparison to looking at our surrounding counties. So we do see that, again, while sales price and rent have decreased in our entire metropolitan statistical area, which is those five counties, it still remains significantly high. Looking at these prices, what you'll see is that really Caldwell is the only county that is relatively more affordable compared to the other four counties. But sadly, it still has a significantly high cost burden. That means even though it's relatively the home prices and rents are more affordable compared to the other four counties, does not necessarily mean that individuals living there earn enough to be able to afford it. And then Hayes is sort of a surprising outlier here in that it has significantly higher rent, highest in the region, higher than Travis County. That, of course, is a big thing. And similarly, at the same time, we see significant amount of folks who are cost burden. So again, overall, Travis, while sort of like middle of the ground within that, looking at it, we still see there's a significant need for affordable housing throughout our entire region, and certainly for Travis County as well. And then just one last thing, which is looking at the number of subsidized affordable units. So really, it's worth, what I really want to point out is that while we see that, yes, Travis County has the most in our region, partially because of the work done by so many partners in our community, including the Housing Authority, regardless, what we do see is that we're not able to keep pace with the growth that's necessary. So some of the counties with actually starting off with fewer units have seen more increases in affordable units than Travis has. Now, of course, our starting point is much bigger, but regardless, there's a lot of work to be done. Thank you, Board. Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Chair, would it be possible for us to get paper copies of your presentation?
Yes, I can share those. Thank you, ma'am. I'll share that with staff, and they can certainly print it, or I can help with that.
Absolutely. And Yves, could you share, you're going to be doing a summit coming up in April that the Housing Authority will be is proud to sponsor, that'll be dealing with many of these issues, and the board would certainly be very welcome to come.
Yes, certainly. So April 11th is a Housing Plus Regional Affordability Summit. Some of you all have been there in the past. We're excited. This time we really focused on regional housing affordability because what we're seeing is that we not only have to address affordability within the city of Austin and Travis County, but have to look within our entire region. Honestly, builds really well on this data. And we're excited. So this is April 11th, full day, and we're really thankful for the Housing Authority sponsoring as well.
What's going on in Hayes County?
So in Hayes County, what we're really seeing is it's a mix. It's partially due to the sort of makeup of towns. I think in places such as Wimberley, Dripping Springs, etc., we've seen a large influx of folks who have actually moved into essentially that those parts of our region. There's extreme growth, but the housing has really not kept pace with that. And you build on it the challenge that they don't have enough of an affordable housing stock to begin with. And as sort of the number of people in the county have grown, but also people in certain professions have grown, particularly in the service industry, they're either having to live outside of the county or outside of towns, and that's partially what's really weighing down on the affordability there.
Seems like Hayes has also become kind of a medical center. And I know ACC has one or more campuses there, so that's creating some of the pressure probably.
Yes, certainly, ma'am. I think both talking about medical facilities, which are slightly better paying, but you're right, there's also a significant number of students. Of course, San Marcos and Texas State is there. Similar to Austin, students slightly can always skew your data because there's lower income for that period of time in which they're studying, but even then we're seeing there's a significant amount of low-income folks with not enough housing resources. And some of it just has to do with the fact that among all the counties, Travis has the most folks who have the greatest need, but also has the most resources, and really those other counties, including Hayes, have very few resources.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Chairman. Thank you, Board.
If you're okay with it, we'd like to do the consent item on the HACA board agenda, and then we'll jump over to the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation and do Iron Rock and address that item because I know we've got a number of guests who are here as well. Mr. Chairman, moving to the consent agenda, item one is presentation, discussion, and possible action regarding the approval of the board minutes summary for the board meeting held on January 16th, 2025. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Carrington moves to approve.
Second.
Duncan Hall seconds. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And the ayes have it. Mr. Chairman, moving over to the regular board meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation, Chair Carrington.
Has it been opened?
It did at 9:12.
Okay. Thank you. Then the one item on the agenda for Austin Affordable Housing Corporation is Resolution 00265, and that is addressing the bridge at Iron Rock Ranch Apartments. I've had a hard time saying Iron Rock Ranch.
Should everybody forward?
Yes, that would be a good idea. Thank you. All right, the first item is approval of the minutes of the board meeting held on January the 16th, 2025. Thank you.
Second. Richie seconds.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you all. Thank you, Commissioner Duncan Hall. Appreciate that. So the bridge at Iron Rock Ranch. That would be Ron Kowal.
Yes, ma'am.
And crew.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners, staff, guests. I'm asking today to present to you resolution number 00265, which is the authorization to move forward with the partnership with our friends at Domain Communities to purchase, step in and be part of the Iron Rock Ranch Apartments. It's currently called Iron Rock Ranch. It's located at 1215 West Slaughter Lane. This is just to the west of a number of assets that we already have. James at South First is just to the east. South Park Landing is across the street from the James and South Park Meadows. We're very, very, very familiar with this area. We've seen tremendous growth in occupancy and demand and the need for affordability there in those areas. We have three of those corners right there at the intersection of South First and Slaughter. And this is another asset in that area that I think is a great opportunity for us. It sits on 22.67 acres. It is 300 units. We have one bedrooms, two bedrooms, and three bedrooms. The exciting thing about this is the size of these units are really, really large. This project was built in 2002, by the way. We have 72 three-bedroom, two-baths at 1,339 square feet, and 60 units there, two-bedroom, two-and-a-half baths. They're like townhomes, which is 1,131 square feet. Also, we have some 72 one-bedrooms, 24 different sizes, 8, 10, and 8, 11, and then another two-bedroom, two-bath plan of 72 units at 1,036. So the units are extremely large. I think it's a great family property. I'm going to introduce you to our partners at Domain here shortly. They have renovated 121 of these units already, I believe, and they look absolutely phenomenal. The property is immaculate. It's well kept. We've got a number of nice amenities, and again, I think the ability for us to preserve the affordability there is a great option for us. But before I go any further, I wanted to introduce you to, this is J.D. Golden, one of the principals. This is Nick Weaver with Domain Communities. I thought maybe since this is a first deal together that we're asking you, that they would come and talk about themselves and tell you a little bit about what they've done. And we've been working with them since 2024, I would say September. They were very patient while Suzanne and I did a very strong vetting process to make sure they're partners, and they good partners, and they did the same to us to make sure we're good partners with them. So I think you'll enjoy visiting with them, and they'll answer any questions you have, then we'll continue. So I'll turn it over to them for a minute.
Thank you, Ron. Good morning, everyone. I am the founder and CEO of a private equity firm called Domain Capital Partners. We've been in business for about 25 years, specializing in buying and renovating multifamily properties throughout the United States, and also is a financial advisory firm for 501c3 corporations. I'm also chairman of a 501c3 corporation called Quality Care Foundation, and we own and operate inpatient psychiatric hospitals in California and Nevada.
Where
in Houston, Texas. You probably can't tell from my youthful appearance, but I've actually been in the affordable housing business for over 40 years. My first job while I was still in college was to work as an intern for the Oklahoma City Housing Authority. So I have a lot of respect for what you do here and what you accomplish. After my internship and after I graduated, I actually worked full-time then for the Housing Authority for another 4 years while I went to law school in the evening. And the experiences and relationships that I got there in those 4 years have shaped my entire career and has helped me sharpen my skills and use those skills and experiences even today while I'm here. So I really respect the work that you do. It's a pleasure to work with Ron and the staff of the Austin Housing Authority, and to kind of go back to my roots once again and get involved in this business. So as Ron mentioned, this property really attracted my attention 4 years ago when we bought it. It was had everything I looked for in a property that includes basically large units, a property that is a garden-style apartment, so we're not stacked up on top of each other, so it's not dense at all. It's a park-like setting, and also it needed work. It was neglected by the former owners, and so it had all the challenges I look for in a property to fix it up and make it more appealing to market to the residents of Austin. So I should have introduced Nick Weaver here from Domain Capital Partners also. He's our asset manager. He was in charge of the massive renovations that we did there and at our other properties as well. So I'm here to answer any questions you may have of me about the project or our company.
Percent at 60%.
Affordable housing at 60%. Now, is any of that available now for those who are currently housed there?
Yes. Actually, we did an examination of the rent roll along with AMP, which is the manager. We went ahead and hired AMP, which I know is the preferred provider for management services for the authority. So we went ahead and hired them. They started yesterday. But as a part of our due diligence, we worked through the rent roll with them, and a large number of our existing residents there already meet those requirements.
And I'll just add to that we're continuing. Our screening criteria for the affordability is rigorous. And there were things in files that we discovered that just weren't there. Income certifications and some applications are missing. We feel comfortable that the property already meets and exceeds the 10% at 60. We've got a few units we feel that are at 30, I think 8 or 9 at 30% AMI. But quite honestly, we don't have a finished lease audit yet. We'll be continuing to do that now that AMP is managing that, should we move forward on our end and get those files recertified and get the residents in to verify where we exactly are. And I'm happy to come back to you in 30 days or so, or our next board meeting, and report to you a full-blown lease audit. We just found a lot of missing information it's not surprising. A lot of management companies don't really care about those types of things that aren't doing affordability. So there's things that we look at differently than when we take over properties. But there are some incomplete files and some incomplete screening criteria things that we don't have. So I think the plan will be for AMP to interview and bring in those residents and start this recertification process to see where we fall. But we are comfortable, based on what we found and what we know of the existing tenant mix, that we'll be well within the compliance side already to start with. We're 93% occupied, I believe.
Yes, trending to 94.
Trending 94. This will be about a $66 million purchase. Our friends will be putting in about $16 million of their own equity into this deal. We'll be financing, I think our resolution calls for not to exceed $55 million, but I think we're going to be closer to 50. Like exactly, I put in 49, 47, 9, 12, but that's probably going to change a little bit. We're also setting aside $2.1 million for additional capital renovations, into the property, and this is financed by Bellwether. We're probably going Fannie Mae, I think, is where we're going to end up.
Yeah, probably. We're looking at all the alternatives for agency financing, along with the BWE, which is the underwriter.
It's a really unique property in that it sits on, like I said, almost 23 acres, and it is really like a park. I mean, it's very, very, very spacious. It's very well, it shows very, very well. I think it's a great opportunity for us, and we're excited, and we hope that with your blessing, we can move forward and start a partnership. We're looking at maybe down the road some other deals together, hopefully. But right now, we're focused on this one, and with your consent, we'd like to move forward on resolution 00265.
Ron, a couple questions. Mm-hmm. What would be the schedule for the renovation of the remainder of the units?
We've done all the heavy lifting at this property. I mean, we started with the units that needed renovation first, and getting them ready to market. Now the remaining units are units that are just need basic cleanup and updating. It's not substantial in any way, and we'll just complete those as they become available. Right now we have units that are available that we've already renovated, but as units turn then, at 94%, the turnover is not substantial, but as units become available, we'll then do a minor renovation of those units.
Can I ask, how are you handling the resident relocation as part of the renovation?
You know, we don't relocate anyone. I mean, we wait until they leave. I mean, if there's something that needs to be done to make it habitable, we've already done it. We did that in the first 3 years of ownership. So we're not relocating anyone. They just stay in their unit, and then we renovate the units when they become available.
And AMP, we had what, 4 or 5 teams of people. We walked every single one of these units, every single one, visual inspections, and to just add to JD's comments, I think what's left are just typical minor. I shouldn't say minor, but just regular make-readies that will do maybe some upgrades, but I think it's only going to be on turns. When someone moves out, we'll go in and get those units ready again. So I think that's kind of the plan.
And you said we're setting aside $2.1 million, was that what you said?
That's correct. The
completion of the renovation.
And other things that kind of has
Yeah, that includes some common areas, improvements. We've built some picnic areas and gathering areas, which are used pretty extensively there. And there's some available park-like spaces that are still available. We want to renovate those and improve them.
When this was built in, what, 2000?
2002.
What was the original financing? Did it have any... Was it any kind of a HUD loan, or was it just conventional financing?
I think it was just conventional. It was built by a REIT, I think, based in Chicago. So, I'm sure they used their own bank financing to build it.
So as far as the tenant files are concerned, it's not that the files were missing information related to original qualification of tenants. They were just incomplete?
I think again, there were some things that we saw in the files that were not there. Proof of, I mean, there's you know, we go back and we look at employment verifications. We ask for payroll checks, so we know what the actual
normal
income
kind
are
of
those,
verification normal for kinds any, of verification any things. Apartment
I think the files were lacking some of those things that we have to have in order to make sure that we're following compliance. And so it's not something we haven't seen in a lot of other properties that we've taken over. The nice thing about having AMP there is they know how to do this and they know how to handle it. They'll have a series of events with residents, bring them in, you know, give them, you know, do a little, whether it's a pizza party or a gift giveaway or something, and then get them to recertify and bring things, and we'll slowly get to that compliance point. I would suspect it'll be, you know, 60 days or so, and we should have everything in, you know, in pretty tip shape. So it's nothing that we haven't done before.
A couple more questions, Ron?
Yes.
Or comments? I would very much like, as I know Commissioner Duncan Hall would like to see, how many residents we have when you all finish your lease audit, how many residents we have below 60%.
I will bring that to
you. You know, that's
all.
Kind of a hot button.
Yes. Right. I will bring that to you all hopefully by next board meeting. I should be able to do that for you by next board meeting.
And of course, we also anticipate perhaps even more units than the 10%.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think we've, you know, the few files that we were able to review, and going off the top of my head, I don't have anything in writing. Because it was just wasn't complete, but I think we already have about 40 something units we had full verifications on, and 9 of those were at 30, I think, and then maybe there were another 8 at 40. So there were substantial, and so if you take the percentages and you just say if out of 40 units we're here, and just average it out, we're probably going to be well in compliance.
Thank you. One more question. Mm-hmm. Did we find you all, or did you find us? How did these discussions begin?
We were introduced, you all know Rex Jones, who's the owner of AMP, Apartment Management Professionals, our management company. Rex has known JD for 30 years. They approached Rex to talk to me, and so it was they came to us. And then we started visiting sometime back in September, October, and just kind of got to know each other and talked about what we're doing and our missions and who is it? Was it CDT? Is it Joe?
Joe Riley. I've also done several deals with CDT.
With CDT as well. So Joe spoke very highly of them as well.
We know CDT.
Yes, we do. And so that was a great referral source for us as well. But they found us.
Okay, great. Any more questions?
A backup question to that.
Commissioner?
Do you have any other properties here in Austin that would fall into the category of affordable housing?
Yes, we have one other property at the moment that we're looking at to bring under this program as well. Mm-hmm. We want to do some additional work there before we bring it to the board.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, do you have any other properties around the country? And if so, how many?
Yeah. Domain Capital has bought properties in Phoenix, Mesa, Tempe, Tucson, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Dallas, Houston, Austin, and Atlanta. So we have, at one time, we had close to 10,000 units. We're always buying and selling properties, but typically we own properties for the long term.
And that would be the expectation here, right?
Yes, yes.
Any more questions for Ron or for our partners here? Okay, then I'd like for the record, since we just sort of skimmed over this, what Resolution 00265 does is the four actions that we typically take The ground lease from the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. Number two, cause the subsidiary limited liability company to own the development, cause the owner to enter into acquisition and development financing, and cause AAHC under the owner to execute any such further documents that are necessary to culminate this transaction. So that's what this resolution does. Do I hear a motion that we approve resolution 00265? And second, Carl. Any more discussion? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And Mary's voting aye. Okay. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, then the motion passes. And so that is the one and only action for Austin Affordable Housing Corporation. So I think we're ready to close this meeting. Do I hear a motion that we close? Carl? Second? Any opposed? Any in favor? Any opposed? Okay. The meeting of the Austin Affordable Housing Corporation is closed at 9:52 a.m. Thank you all. Thanks for being here. We look forward to the partnership. That's another one we have to visit, Ron. Where'd he go? Is he already gone? Oh, okay.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman, we'll return to the main HACA agenda. We'll go ahead and pick up item number four, which is the same item, just ratifying it at the HACA level. Item number four is presentation, discussion, and possible action on resolution number 202880 by the Board of Commissioners of HACA to take the following actions with regard to the Bridge at Iron Rock Ranch Apartments in Austin, Texas. One, acquire the site of the development. Two, lease the development site to the owner of the development. And three, such other actions necessary or convenient to carry out this resolution. If you've heard much of the discussion just before, are there any further questions regarding this item from Mr. Kowal? If not, Mr. Duncan Hall moves approval.
Seconded by Commissioner Carrington.
All in favor?
Is there first, is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. We go to item number two, which is a discussion, presentation, and possible action regarding resolution number 2878, approval of the revised utility allowance schedules for the Housing Choice Voucher Program.
Thanks so much.
Are we going to approve events first?
You already approved them.
We did.
We did? Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
Ma'am.
I didn't get
that.
I missed that.
Richie and Duncan Hall seconded.
Okay.
4-0.
All right. And that was for
the minutes for the
not for AAHC. Oh, I skipped over AAHC.
We went back and picked it up. Duncan Hall approved the minutes. Okay. Motioned and Richie seconded. Item number two is the approval of the revised utility allowance schedules, and Laura Bodai is here to present. This is an item that I think we can handle very, very quickly because we are trying to move towards an executive session. Unfortunately, this is an item that we continue to see utility costs escalate in our city, some years more rapidly than others, but it's advising you largely. Unfortunately, it is something that really is so much out of our hands. But I'll let Laura give you a quick briefing on it and then respond to any questions you have. Laura?
Good morning, members of the board, fellow HACA staff and clients. Yes, as Mike said, this is required by 24 CFR 282.517 that we review the utility allowance schedules on an annual basis. And if they result in an increase of 10% or more, we adopt the new schedules. So we used, again, NELROC Company, which we've used for years, to conduct the study, and their results did come back with an overall increase of over 10%. So I am recommending that we adopt the new schedules that they presented, which you will see in your attachments. Was that fast enough, Mike?
That was absolutely fast enough. You're an award winner. I would just note for members of our board, this is paid, and we continue to receive sort of the same cap of funding. The pot's not grown bigger, so it just means our ability to do less. So it's as utility costs go up and we're obligated to cover those increases, it just means our ability to house fewer people, and we're very concerned about what cuts are proposed in Washington. That could result in dramatic cuts nationwide in the Section 8 program. So this is one part of a storm that is brewing.
Yeah, it does. I mean, depending on the calculation is a little bit too complicated to go into right now. But the payment standards already increased a little earlier. So with utility allowance increase, I mean, the HAP costs do go up for a number of clients, but not all, depending on if they hit the payment standard ceiling or not. So, but it does result in an increase and a slight impact to our to the number of households that we can serve. Yeah. But it is a requirement. They did go up again overall over 10%, but some, you know, didn't go up dramatically more than that. We saw the biggest increases in the natural gas charges and also the sewer. But other than that, it was around 10% or even a little lower for some line items. So, are there any questions?
You said it would affect perhaps the number of voucher holders that we have?
Our HAP costs will go up slightly. Again, not for all clients, but for some. The HAP charge will be, the HAP amount, excuse me, will increase a little bit.
So the HAP or the housing assistance payment
Yes.
is the amount that we are obligated to pay to the landlord.
Right.
And so the amount that we will pay the landlord will now go up, but it may mean that because we're going to see that across our portfolio, and the pot of money that's available to us has stayed constant, it means that we'll at the end of the day likely be able to serve, fewer households. Yeah. It's another pressure.
Some sense of percentage.
So we don't know. Yeah. Go ahead.
So when the utility costs go up, it's a direct pass-through. So we got a set amount that we pay that increases that. So the residents' amount to pay doesn't increase. It's just that we can only pay less in rent. So their utilities are actually covered through the 70% that we pay to the landlord. But that 70% gets, all of a sudden, it gets diced up. So it's not going up. It just takes up more within the pie.
Right.
And so, therefore, when the rents increase, because we're paying more in utility allowances, then we can't pay as much in rent when rents increase. Because
right.
as landlords ask. But fortunately, lately, rents have not increased as high. I mean, they have increased, but they haven't increased as high. So, like, when you saw a 10% increase, then you see, like, you know, a slight increase, you know. So they're not going up as high, but they are still increasing where they are now.
And the storm I alluded to, Commissioner, was that right now we don't have a federal budget, and so the projections are based on what the Senate and the House have each approved in their respective budget bills, is that there could be a significantly lower amount of funding to this program. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's very likely. And NARO is
that pretty much a definite?
No, but it appears likely. It appears likely, but it's not definite. But should that happen, what NARO is projecting is that as many as 200,000 families across the country might not have rental assistance through this program. That would certainly, some number of those would be in Texas, some number of those would be here in Austin, but we don't know.
Increased the number of vouchers last year.
We've gotten more special purpose vouchers, but we have not increased the Housing Choice Voucher Program for quite some time. If we have, it's been just a few here, but generally the trend has been down on the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We have gotten vouchers to help the homeless, the mainstream program. We've gotten more VASH vouchers. We've gotten other types of special purpose, but not the main Section 8 program. So not wonderful news, but just utility costs are going up just as the rent is and everything else. And with that reality, we'd ask for your approval of Resolution 2878 of the utility allowance schedules.
Commissioner Bailey came in at 9:59.
Oh, great. Commissioner Bailey, can you hear us? Commissioner Bailey?
Chair Medica.
Okay, well.
So with that, the chair will. So with that, the chair will entertain a motion to approve item number 2878, which is the revised utility allowance schedules for the Housing Choice Voucher Program.
So moved.
Motion made by Commissioner Carrington.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Duncan Hall. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, item number three is the is a presentation discussion possible action regarding resolution 2879, approval of revisions to the personnel policies and procedures manual of the Housing Authority of the City of Austin. Sylvia and Lauren Aldridge, our outside general counsel, are going to brief on that.
Can y'all hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
I see myself
Yes, we can.
The old gray-headed man, that's fine. I'll try to stay away.
All right. Good morning, commissioners, staff, and guests. Sylvia Calderon, Chief Operating Officer, here on behalf of Human Resources to request some proposed revisions to the Housing Authority of the City of Austin's personnel policies and procedures. It boils down to three main topics. One is the hybrid work schedule policy. It's really just memorializing the change that we made to go from 2 days in the office to 3 days in the office, and that's been in effect since January of this year. The second item is a revision to the grievance policy to align it with current employees, not former employees. And the third topic is increasing the introductory, also known as the probationary period, for new employees, new hires. Currently, it's been at 90 days, and we wish to increase that to 180 days. And just to give you a little bit more context on that, it's really just to ensure that not only the Housing Authority, but also new hires have more time to ensure that it's going to be a good fit, not only for the organization, but also for the employee. Gives us time to assess performance and just align with the overall goals and objectives of the position that the employee has been hired for. And this is not out of the ordinary. The city and the state have typically had 180-day introductory periods, so this is kind of aligning more along the lines of governmental entities.
Mr. Chairman, I might add one just for an example. In the Section 8 program that we were just talking about, and really throughout all of rental assistance, team members there come and really spend their first 60 days to 90 days working through an extensive training and certification process. And so they're not really sort of cut loose to actually have the client loads and do the hard work really until that second 90 days. And so this is an important period for us to be able to, you know, evaluate those team members fairly and to you know, make sure that, you know, we're doing justice by all sides, you know, of it. But that's just one example. The same is true in our public housing operations and really throughout any area that, you know, there's just the work is complex and there's just a more challenging ramp up, oftentimes requiring, you know, certifications from outside entities. So we feel like 180 days lines up well with that.
How has the, because on January 1, you went back, or we went back to 3 days in the office as opposed to 2 days in the office, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And how has that gone? I mean, have we lost employees as a result of that, or pretty much everybody complied?
We've lost two, one from Southwest Housing, and I thought there was one other, but I'm drawing a blank.
Maybe one in Pathways Asset Management, perhaps, but yeah. It has been very, very little attrition as a result of the going from 2 days to 3 days in the office. It wasn't a mass exodus. And so I think it has, excuse me, helped with the team building, ensuring that we can have those conversations at a moment's notice that we need to have. So it does work, and it has been working effectively.
And there's space available for everyone you've given them. renovations going on?
There is, yes. Yes, Commissioner, we do have the third floor that has been vacant, and so we've been able to provide plenty of swing space on the third floor for everyone.
Okay.
I'll make one other mention, and it may be a little edgy, but, you know, we've had a number of team members who have gone to HUD, who have gone to go work at HUD, because HUD's at different points is actively recruited from here. And so, you know, one of the refrains I'd occasionally hear from folks is, well, if that doesn't work out, I'll just go work at HUD. Well, obviously, we've seen HUD's ranks, being decimated in the last, several weeks. And, I think we're seeing folks really dig in deeper here, which is nice. You're seeing some, some renewed commitment. I think some folks who, none of us should ever take our jobs for granted. I'm grateful for this job, and I know that others are as well. And I think more folks are realizing we do really good work here. And frankly, we may be among some of the last standing, in this work if we see continued erosion of capabilities at HUD and at the federal level. And, there's not really a state entity for these programs. There's a state housing agency that does the tax credit program and a few other good things. But for this, where it's really individual care, family care, we do this well. And so we're very anxious about what's happening at the federal level and certainly feel for our colleagues at HUD. But I think a lot of folks are digging in at a deeper level, and it's an exciting and a challenging time here all at the same time.
Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
Exciting is not the word that I'm hearing about most of this stuff. The question, and this is, yeah, I probably covered this while I was still taking the meeting with the team. Have we actually had somebody come down and fire people?
No, we have, and we've not had that. No housing authority, to the best of my knowledge, has had that happen. And we're not a federal, entity. We had when the worst that we had was that day where OMB issued the memo saying that all federal funds were frozen for a review, but that was quickly addressed. We had already drawn down all the funds for February, and it was quickly clarified that programs that receive that are providing individual assistance, which ours do, weren't affected at that point. To the extent that there are grants, we are concerned about what federal cuts could mean for grants. The Family Self-Sufficiency Program, which we think should be a favorite, appears to be a grant that may be under scrutiny. We do have a Family Self-Sufficiency Program that's pretty dynamic here. And there are other grants that we've received that are smaller, but nothing that affects really kind of the huge programs that we have. Obviously, FSS and some of the other grants that we get could affect some of the things that really breathe life and soul into helping lift people up. So we're watching it really closely, and the chairman's been very involved with that at the national level, as have I, and I know all of you are watching as well. We'll keep you posted on what we're hearing. But there are concerns, and it's worth probably at our next board meeting walking through some of the ramifications as we understand them, particularly for the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which seems to be the one most under scrutiny.
Now, did I understand you to say that we're having training sessions for our residents?
No, we've not done any kind of training or programs for residents. We have advised residents in the context of immigration issues, which I think you may be referring, of resources in the community, but we've been very careful to stay in our lane and mindful of our obligations because of our federal funding. So I think we'd want to be very, very careful about that, and we're seeking a lot of advice from council. That's non-federal and can't be touched. That's at the full discretion of this board.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you got well in hand as best you can.
Yeah. Well, we're trying. Every day is a new thing. But for purposes of right now, and there may be an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that in a bit. We want to try to jump into executive session as quickly as we can and save at least an hour if we can for that. But we would ask your approval of Resolution 2879, making changes to the Policy and Procedures Manual.
So move.
Carrington moves, Duncan Hall seconds. Is there any further discussion?
A question. When will this go into effect?
It will go into
effect. Oh, I see it. Never mind. Immediately.
Yes.
Okay.
I do have another question. The introductory period for the 180-day extension, will that people who are under that 180 days, are they required to work here on the premises, or do they also have the opportunity to work remotely?
During the introductory period, it's really intended for employees to be in the office, but it can be on a case-by-case basis determined if it's a good fit for employees to perform a hybrid work schedule during the introductory period. Yes.
I was just wondering about how you enculturate them into the organization if they're working remotely.
Exactly. The expectation would be that new hires would be in office in order to cultivate that relationship, as you referenced.
So I do have one question. So although we will approve this and it will go into effect immediately, but will it be prospective? In essence, if I'm a new employee and I've been here for 75 days mm-hmm. and this goes into effect, are you telling me that I've got to go another period of time to get to 180? Or am I grandfathered in and so when I get to 90 days, I'm off the probational steroids, or do I?
Right, that's a great question. Council?
I mean, there's no, in terms of what the probationary period is,
the probationary period is designed, I think, to give the supervisors time to evaluate. There's not really a benefit or detriment to the employee, right? I mean, it doesn't change their pay or their roles or their duties. If you want to accelerate them off of it, I don't think that there's a problem with that. Is that kind of what you're asking, like a 90-day?
Well, I think
I'm just saying if you got hired, mm-hmm. and you got hired 60 days ago and you were told you were going to be on a 90-day probationary period and you're in day 61, we pass this, and all of a sudden, you being told now your probationary period is going to be longer.
I think it should be applicable to hires as of the date that the policy has changed.
And that's what I'm just getting clarification on.
Yes.
Because it would seem to be, I'm not sure whether it impacts benefits or whatever, because, mm-hmm. again, it's more of an evaluation period, but to the extent that it would have impact on somebody's insurance or whatever, other benefits. If they were in day 61 and all of a sudden they got told, oh, well,
another 3 months to go.
Yeah, you got another 3 months to go, then I think that would be somewhat unfair because that's not what they were told when they were hired.
That's understandable.
Changing the rules of the game.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yes. We don't want to move goalposts on anyone. I think it'll go into effect immediately for hires that start today or
today.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
That should perhaps be clarified in writing.
On implementation, it'll start for new hires who are hired after today.
Yes, after today.
So Carrington moved and Duncan Hall seconded. Any further questions? As for all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? And the motion carries. Item number 5 is presentation, discussion, and possible action regarding Resolution 2882, approval of the renewal of the employee medical vision and dental insurance with United Healthcare. Janet Forbes with Arthur J. Gallagher is here with us. She's been our steadfast insurance broker and consigliere on all things insurance for quite some time now. We want to sort of have the abbreviated version of this, but the short story is, as I understand it, is basically given our utilization over the last year, where we had a number of significant healthcare costs, and we had, we have an older population of team members, that we had a high utilization rate, and that warranted a united rebid for the same continuity of services of 18.4%.
Yeah, that was the final negotiated 18.4% on the medical.
Yep.
Correct.
And vision and dental was
10% on the dental, and then the vision was a flat 0%.
So it's not a lovely picture regarding, you know, escalating medical and dental costs. And we've talked about some things we can do to try to address those costs here. One of the big things that we're going to be doing is taking spouses who may have be eligible for insurance at other at their place of employment, and we would ask, we'll insist that they receive coverage through that other through their employer, versus, and that would start, we're looking to start that next year, not this year, but that's one step that we're looking to take to try to address, you know, costs. Obviously, if folks, we think it would affect some, but everyone would have medical insurance. They would just be getting it through their employer, and through their employer versus HACA absorbing that cost. So we're going to work our way into that and give people a year of heads up on that. But now, if they don't have access to health insurance, they absolutely can come through us.
Yeah. To answer your question, there are 64 people on the plan now that have spousal coverage, either through Employees Plus Spouse or Employee Plus Family.
So we have 64.
There are 64 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. We'll come off of.
Potentially. So if they do have access to benefits with their own employer, then HACA would ask them to participate with their own employer plan versus participating here.
So let me just get clarification. Hearing. What you're saying is you've identified 64 employees who are married, who potentially could have someone.
Correct.
But you don't know whether that spouse is unemployed or whether they are.
Correct.
Have an employer. So you don't have that number. Okay. So I guess what we would like is, during this year, we would get that number so we would know exactly how many people are impacted.
Yeah, and we don't know that from the census that we get. We can't determine whether someone has gainful employment somewhere else. So normally you would have them sign an affidavit letting you know that they do or don't have employment elsewhere with access to benefits.
We'll let you work out the procedure. We just want the number.
We want people to be insured.
Absolutely.
So were they to lose a job, if the spouse were to lose a job, that would be a life-altering event, and we would be able to secure coverage for them under our plan. So we're not trying to have people uninsured, but we are trying to have people tap into the insurance that their companies make available for them, often at very reduced cost.
And can I add to something? So when you were talking about the process and how we arrived at 18.4%, so UnitedHealthcare goes into looks at 24 months of claims experience through the month of August of this last year. Even, in September, October, your loss ratio at that time that they did the renewal was 131%. So for every dollar, they're paying $1.31 out in claims. So for the months of September and October, that loss ratio went up to in excess of 140%. So there is higher utilization, and if most of us have been here a while, know that the years when we were dealing with very low single-digit increases, flat increases, because the utilization at that time was running more in the 70%. So that has gone up significantly over the last few years. So just wanted to put that into some perspective in negotiations that we did with UnitedHealthcare to get them to where they are today. They initially came out with a 24% increase, which we then negotiated down to the 18.4 that you see.
You basically answered my question, but if it were to continue to increase next year, are you then forced to go out into the market to look for another provider?
We do recommend that you go out periodically to look at the market to see what other options are, because there are continually new options in the marketplace, either through different models of the plans, different plan designs, mm-hmm. different arrangements that we can look at, even from a funding perspective. So those are things that we continue to evaluate, but certainly do recommend that the Housing Authority do go out periodically to do a full RFP, and that's what we would recommend you do for this next year.
One of the models that Janet has talked about extensively with us is a self-funding model mm-hmm. That would be administered by, you know, an entity like United or another healthcare provider. We've asked Barbara and Michael Cummings and others who will, I think Michael Ross joining in, but there's a number of folks who will join in on a little task force with Janet mm-hmm. to explore that issue this year. We're trying to figure out how to if that's something that would be viable for us. There are some other models in the market. We've switched to other models at different points, and I think folks have struggled. There's also some new folks on the market that are, you know, Curative is on the market. They have a nice big building down on Congress there near the Capitol. And, you know, there's, you know, it. We're an agency, though, that needs a lot of healthcare services continuity. Otherwise, you know, we've got a lot of folks with, you know, circulatory issues and, you know, chronic health issues and, you know, diabetes care and heart disease. And so we've just got a number of issues. And so we have to make sure that the platform we move from one to the other isn't so disruptive that we, you know, really do affect people's, you know, care and quality of life. So we're working through that.
How long has it been since we went out for an RFP?
2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been a couple of years.
Yeah. And we've done it periodically. We've always ended up, in the last 10 years at United. But there's no love lost with United, to be sure. And I've been very critical of United. And, I think they're a bit heavy-handed in how they work with us and others in the market. And I think, you know, people in the broader community have felt the same about their insurance companies. But we're working through it, thanks to Janet and her more even temperament.
So let me ask this question. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, we're kind of crunched on time, but I'm just throwing this out since we're just having a discussion. It may sound ridiculous, but do companies bifurcate their employees into different plans? So let me give you an example. I'm just thinking creatively. Several months ago, we had a discussion about entry-level employees, $21 an hour, da-da-da. And so in some cases, you know, it's above minimum wage. And I'm thinking maybe some of those employees could get health care through Sendero. I mean, it's a low-cost insurance plan. You know, you take those who could qualify economically through that plan, and then others, you peel them off, because, you know, with Sendero, a lot of the folks they deal with are folks who have chronic health problems, and it's a low-cost product. And then others, you know, who are described as more healthy, you can put them into another plan where you're paying less, because as you're the healthier, younger employees, you tend to pay less because there's less utilization. And I don't know that. And I'm, like I said, again, I'm just throwing this out in terms of something to think about. But and we don't even really have to answer now because given we're time. Mm-hmm. But it's just something to think through in terms of it. Because, again, I don't know. I don't really know insurance. My wife does. But and so that's why I don't even just talk about it. But I'm just thinking out loud, is there a way to bifurcate?
Well, you also have to be very careful of anti-selection. So the carriers are going to look at the census, and they're going to want all your eligible population. If you start carving off, say, the healthy population, then that's really going to negatively impact the folks that are still left on the plan. What we would do is look at a scenario where you've got different choices. So you've got a low-cost option, a middle-cost option, and maybe a high. Right now you have one option for employees to choose from, so we would want to create a model where there's choice. So if I make a certain level of income, and based on my utilization and my needs for my family, I might opt to go into a lower cost option. So that may accomplish what you're talking about, and I do understand where your train of thought is going.
Okay, because when I was on the Sendero board, I remember our products, we offered various levels, and so people can choose mm-hmm. what we call sort of the gold program, or they could go with the bronze program. But it was a cost that they, it's what they chose, what they could afford, and that's what I'm just trying yep. to, that's what I'm trying to
and
get
then
to.
HACA can contribute more to maybe the lower cost plan, allow people to either buy down or buy up. So there's a different modeling that we can do as we continue to evaluate that.
Yeah. All right.
In the past, one other question. In the past, haven't we had sort of a cafeteria plan where employees could select certain kinds of coverage that they wanted?
It's been many years since we've had those two options, perhaps for staff to choose from. Over time, we've just consolidated into one offering. But it is something that we have explored. I think we would probably need to increase some efficiencies and some administrative burdens to be decreased to allow for our HR department to administer more than one plan. But that is something that we have explored.
And have done in the past.
We've done it in the long past.
I didn't think I made that up, so.
Yeah.
Probably before I got here.
Exactly. Yes, it was before Mr. Gerber's tenure.
Yeah. So yeah, it was before 2012.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think Barbara has raised a very frightening concern over the last 2 years, 3 years, If you compound what the increases have looked like, our insurance with this 18-point-whatever increase means that it's going to be a 44% increase in our healthcare coverage cost to the agency. Which is just not sustainable. So, with Barbara's lead and Michael Cummings, who's been active in employee efforts as well, and Michael's group is actually a great. If you talk about sort of peeling folks off, now that we would want to peel folks off, but they are operating their business because of the work they do in a slightly different way. They're all part of HACA, but Southwest Housing, has other economic factors driving it. Through its relationships with HUD. And so we've looked at, high deductible plans to see if that would make us more competitive in, the bidding process as we, try to lower costs all around, because you have to factor those in when you bid, if we rebid on work with HUD. So lots of things to think about, but I think it's important for the board to know. Medical costs will be a big topic this year.
Do we run the risk of United just saying, I'm going to discontinue our coverage for you?
No, they'll just adjust the rates to where they feel like they can be affordable going forward. They're not going to just say in 1 year, nope, we're not going to continue. Now, what you do may sometimes encounter is when we go out to market, you'll have other carriers say, we're either not as competitive as United Healthcare, we're not willing to take on the risk, and they'll just flat out decline to quote. So you always have that situation. But United Healthcare, they're not going to come back and just pull it.
A personal comment. Currently, I am the victim of an insurance company saying, we're not going to cover that property because you had a loss 2 years ago. So.
Yeah, I can kind of speak to that a little bit. I mean, property and casualty is different. And the only reason why I know it is because my wife used to be in that business, and State Farm pulled out of California a long time ago. And
they're
so,
the ones who canceled my insurance.
Yeah,
so.
And so, I mean, they are very, their business model, it is a for-profit deal, and if a area, whether it's a state, community, or whatever, if it's not profitable, they pull out. I mean, Detroit, literally, I don't think there's very few people who have property and casualty insurance in Detroit, and that has been for years. But insurance, like on the property and casualty side, they just, it's all about, insurance is a mitigation of loss, mitigation of risk, and they try to mitigate their risk so they can enhance their profit. And so, but on the healthcare side, it's a lot different.
They just increase our premiums.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is what's happening.
That is what's happening.
Because, unlike in the property casualty side, if all of a sudden they just start losing folks, all of a sudden the pot gets so small that the few people who are left in it have to pay so much, then they leave, and there's no customers to pay premiums. And they only make money when they pay premiums.
Sure.
That was the one thing I learned from my wife about insurance.
Okay. Thank you.
Ready for a vote?
Yep. So this is resolution number 2882, approving employee medical vision and dental insurance. Is there a motion to approve?
So move.
Duncan.
Second.
Farrington moves. Duncan Hall seconds. Is there any further questions?
When will this be communicated to employees?
The effective date is 4/1, so we go through open enrollment process the beginning of March.
Yes, we have open enrollment meetings scheduled for the first week in March.
Okay. Thank you.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And just confirming, Commissioner Bailey, you're good? Can you confirm?
Yeah, yes, Ethan.
And Apostolo?
Don't see.
Does he have a question?
I assume Commissioner Apostolo is.
There she is.
Commissioner Apostolo, you're good? Great. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
That's all the items that we have on the agenda. Thanks, Janet. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
We'd like to move into executive session. May I read it out, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
The board may go into executive session, close its meeting to the public pursuant to A551.071 of the Texas Government Code. Consultations with attorney regarding legal advice pending or contemplated litigation or settlement offer. Let me invite the staff. Now's a great time to go. Unless you're staying. Ron, why don't you hang? Ron. You got to leave the recording on because I need to read it into the recording.
Will they be able to participate?
Yes, they'll be able to join.
Hey, Ron.
Ron's staying.
Let me
551.071 of the government code for consultations with attorneys regarding legal advice pending or contemplated litigation or settlement offer. 551.072 of the government code for discussion about the purchase, exchange, lease, or value of real property. C 551.074 of the Texas government code for discussion of the appointment, employment, evaluation, or assignment, duties, discipline, or dismissal of a public officer or employee, or to hear a complaint or charge against an officer or employee. D 551.087 of the Texas Government Code to discuss certain economic development negotiations. And we're pausing the main HACA board meeting at 10:32.
And that impacts organizations like the old Texas Housing Foundation. Oh, Lubbock. Oh.
He was part. He bought those assets from Lubbock.
Who can answer?
They got foreclosed.
These guys seem like good guys.
They are great.
Okay, well, we're glad that you...
Their other partner, Joe Carroll, he worked with CDT, and so did JD, but I spent a lot of time talking to...
When you say worked with CDT, then you worked for CDT?
And then they left CDT. This was years and years ago. CDT was looking at doing some equity into this deal.
Did they live in New York, or they were working with CDT or working for CDT?
They were, Joe Carroll's income, he was in New York.
He was in New York. Yeah. Is he in Houston now?
He is, no, just JD's in Houston. Joe is in somewhere in the East Coast.
Okay.
I can't remember now. I deal a lot more with JD and Nick's the brain child.
Yeah, he was the equity guy. He was the capital markets guy. Are you still having conversations? Do you periodically have conversations with CDT about it?
Oh, Joe's coming Friday.
Oh, okay. Very
cool. And then he's meeting Saturday, and then on Monday, his whole asset management team's coming in for a week.
So when he comes in on Friday, are they looking at some transactions? Are they looking at something that Conservancy is doing? Or?
No, I think it's more looking at our existing portfolio and figuring out, you know, what next steps are. I think there's a couple assets that are need capital infusions. And then there's, you know, what do we do with this? What's our
long-term making jettison. Basically doing an evaluation of the whole portfolio.
That's what we're basing on.
Their portfolio with us.
And they have a new asset manager they hired. She has not been here, ADI, and I have not met her. She just talked to her on the phones. But she's coming, and she's going to get her feet wet and see all
the
assets.
Who was the other?
Kevin Schmidt was the guy that used to come out of Michelle Menudo. So Kevin got moved out of our portfolio to another spot, and they hired this new person.
Okay.
She's good.
And I know I can go through all this and count, but it's easier to ask you. How many transactions do we have with CDT?
Five or six.
Okay. How many does the Conservancy have? More than that.
Yeah, because we bought it. We put them in a couple of Bell Run deals, some CDT deals, and an enterprise deal.
Okay.
Let's start. You want us in the first part?
You said. Let's start on the easy stuff first. I guess I have to read. Can you open up the meeting, Mr. Chair?
All right. So the Housing Authority for the City of Austin is in executive session pursuant to Texas Government Code Sections 551.071, 072, 074, and 087, dealing with legal advice, exchange, purchase, exchange lease of value of real property, discuss employment evaluation, reassignment, and economic development negotiations. And so we are officially called to order at 10:40 on Thursday, February 20th.
Thank you. Mr. Get a session to cover a variety of legal issues, and there's no action to be taken by the board. And with that, Madam Chair, I would just say that there's a variety of staff updates that we'll share with you at the next board meeting, but thank you for your attention today, and we look forward to seeing you. No board meeting in March, but we will work on a date for April, given this movement of the legislative session. So that's your flexibility.
Is there anything else that you want to do in terms of a president's report to the board?
Communities and schools luncheon is happening next week. There's a citywide advisory report that Lupe, but given the weather, was not able to make it out today. But suffice to say, a lot happening among our community development programs, working with in the scholarship program, working with AISD, working with in the healthcare space for mobile vaccine clinics, and also on digital inclusion.
One thing about the scholarship program, I hope that they will continue the efforts they made last year to really go out and recruit people.
Oh, yeah.
Because we did have a significant increase last year, and I thought that was good. And
absolutely.
I would like to see that number continue to increase.
Absolutely. We will definitely continue that. One sad bit of news that I'll share with you, and Mary, you'll probably be interested in this as well. Commissioner Obstoli, you'll be interested in this as well. So Catherine Crego, who's been with us for 10 years, shared that she's going to step back, and she's dealing with some, she lost her father not long ago, and is dealing with some family issues, and so she'll be leaving us, and that's a big loss to our digital inclusion work, and
right.
So much of our pathways work, and you know, she's just a lovely, lovely person.
Right.
So
right.
We'll miss her very much.
Yeah, that is sad.
But with that, Madam Chair,
we will send her with our best wishes for
absolutely.
The board. Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's all we've got. We'd recommend a motion to adjourn.
Okay.
Commissioner Carrington,
is there a motion to adjourn our meeting? Is there a second?
Commissioner Obstoli, would you move to adjourn?
Okay. And Mary seconds.
Okay.
So all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
And we're adjourned at 12:21.
Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners.